From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Philippe Jaillet, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Dan Raviv, National Correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News. Our moderator is White House Correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandes.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. More twists and turns in the debate over security on America's southern border with Mexico. More Democratic candidates are entering the presidential campaign. We'll also talk about the Munich Security Conference, also a U.S.-led conference on Iran, and the latest on Venezuela. Well, let's talk about this issue concerning President Trump and what he says, gentlemen, is a crisis on the southern border with Mexico. The president shut down the government, as you know, about 2 months ago. That didn't work out for him, and he wants to avoid that now, but it looks like he wants a national emergency declared that will enable him to move some money around and build some kind of barrier on the wall. It's hard to kind of keep track, Dan, of everything that's going on.
What a week.
Bring our listeners up to speed.
Yeah, what a week it was, no question about it. Yeah, there was a 35-day shutdown of a major part of the U.S. government in December and January. And the president at the time said, I'm proud to do that because that is going to push my issue that there needs to be a wall on the U.S. border with Mexico. The Democrats said, you go ahead, it's going to be unpopular. And it caused damage. It certainly hurt 800,000 government employees who generally didn't have to come to work, eventually got back pay, but then there are tens of thousands of other people who depend on those government jobs. They have contracts with the government, or they even own the lunch counters and the cafes around government buildings. So a lot of economic damage. And in the end, what was the result? Well, another round of negotiations over whether a wall or some security barrier can be built on the border. And the president got less money from Congress than he could have gotten in December. And so he wanted $5.7 billion. The bill that was passed by the Senate and the House, the president reluctantly said he would sign it, gives him about $1.4 billion for that purpose. And that's why the White House told us he's going to declare a national emergency, that it's that important, that dangerous people and drugs have been coming in from the southern border, and he will divert billions of dollars from other projects and will build a wall, even though Congress did not approve it. It's a pretty big step.
Well, there's a lot to unpack about from all of everything that Dan said, Philippe. And one thing, just briefly, is it's sort of ancillary to this. El Chapo, as he's known, this big-time Mexican drug kingpin, was convicted in a New York court this week. Looks like he's off to prison for the rest of his life. But part of the trial, evidence and testimony emerged that said that all of these drugs that the president says are pouring over the border, he says they're going through these legal ports of entry. In other words,
right.
A wall will not stop them. How much of what President Trump is saying about the need for this wall is truth, and how much is just not so?
Well, it's the heart of the debate. From the beginning, the president, since he was a candidate, has encapsulated his tough immigration policy into one symbol, which is the wall. And it's a slogan on the campaign trail, and it has come to really encapsulate everything he wants to do with the border. But we know, even before El Chapo trial, that from border agents, that 90 or 95% of the drugs go through, you know, hidden in trucks or cars through the regular checkpoints at the border. So,
in other words, the wall won't stop that at all.
Probably not. The wall helps stop illegal aliens wanting to cross the border illegally.
Well, don't forget, one of the president's big purposes seems to be to stop people from just walking across the border and declaring, I want political asylum. Right? Life is unsafe for me. And so he and his supporters, Trump and his supporters, think that's terrible. Why is that in the law? It is in United States law. You can wander into the United States and demand asylum. He figures if you build a wall, you'll get fewer people wandering across.
That's where the definition of a crisis at the border, it will be debated, including in court, probably, because those people are asylum seekers. They don't flee when they see a U.S. uniform. They go to them, and they want to apply to a legal process that is called asylum. It's totally different from the illegal alien who wants to enter the country and disappear.
And maybe be a terrorist, etc. But there, all these parts of it are there. I'm sure all of you have heard from Homeland Security officials here in Washington who do look at this seriously. And they don't think it'll eliminate the drug smuggling. They don't think it will eliminate the terrorism threat. First, they admit privately the president wants this done. It was a campaign promise. But second, they say it will reduce some of the illegality. And that's where Democrats chime in and say, that's not worth billions and billions of dollars. It's a minor problem, which the president is calling a national emergency.
Just one point quickly. The problem also is that this administration doesn't want those asylum seekers to come. They have set in place a new policy that requires them to wait on the other side of the border in Mexico until their file is approved or declined. And that is contrary to not only international law, but the American law. And this adds up to what the Democrats call a humanitarian crisis, which is not a security crisis. It's an influx of asylum seekers. So that's the debate.
You know, this debate seems to have the way the president has framed it and maybe the way people think about events these days. It's very binary. You're either one or the other. And yet there are some facts here that really aren't being discussed. I mean, the president seems to think that, Democrats want to open borders and they're fine with bad people coming. Democrats want, poll after poll shows all Americans want better border security, but the debate is really how to do it. And even Border Patrol agents say, well, I'm not sure a wall is really the way. What we need are, say, more drones, more infrared sensors. In other words, more technology, more agents at these legal ports of entry. Not necessarily a wall, but that is what President Trump has anchored himself to. We have to have a physical wall.
Well, he's an optics man. The appearance of things is what's important. He'll want to declare a victory. He'll want to have at least one section of wall that he can point to as part of his reelection campaign. Late next year, he hopes to be reelected as president. That's a big part of this. Just one other thing. Almost every member of Congress you ask about the immigration issue says, it's so divisive, we don't seem to be able to change anything, but the system is outmoded, it's unclear, and therefore foreigners sometimes head for the United States thinking they can come in even without paperwork, and that doesn't help anyone. However, I don't see any sign Congress is going to fix it.
All right. Well, speaking of the presidential campaign, Dan is correct that the president is clearly gearing up for re-election in 2020, and the election is still 21 months away, and yet things are getting awfully busy there. A whole bunch of Democrats, at least 9 major Democratic candidates who are in the race. Now, it's still early, Felipe, but what strikes you from as interesting at this stage of the race?
Obviously, many women entering the race with a lot of impetus, I think, in their campaign. Kamala Harris, a senator from California, Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota, Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts, and I wouldn't discount Kirsten Gillibrand, who succeeded Hillary Clinton when she was appointed as Secretary of State.
Let's just take a broader picture for a second. I sometimes hear from Democrats, of course, crushed by their defeat in 2016. How did Donald Trump become president? They say, maybe we shouldn't have a woman this time. Maybe we shouldn't have an ethnic minority this time. Maybe this is the time, just play it safe. And they sometimes privately define that as an older white man. That argument, by the way, points to former Vice President Joe Biden, for instance, as their model candidate. And then others say, what are you talking about? Hillary Clinton did get more votes than Mr. Trump in 2016, just not in the right states, so the electoral votes didn't add up the way they should. And so there's a debate within the party in various ways. That also is about appearances, by the way. Should we look like we're a traditional party, that's white men in effect, or should we look progressive and liberal? Of course, behind it is a political argument, whether the Democratic Party should be more progressive. A lot of the new members of Congress are.
What's interesting is if you look at the polls at this point, I think polls at this point are more or less just a reflection of name recognition than anything else, which is why Biden, who is clearly a household name, he was vice president for 8 years and the Senate for 36 years. Everybody knows who he is. And some of the other candidates that people know who Elizabeth Warren is, and the others perhaps not so much. But Biden is interesting, Dan, in that if you talk to White House officials, he seems to be the one person that President Trump appears to maybe, I'm not sure if fear is the right, quite the right word, but he would really put up, that would be a very interesting race. Except to come back to one thing you said, there are surveys, though, of millennials who this year will pass the baby boomers as the biggest group in the United States. It can't be discounted. Polls of millennials, these younger people, say we don't want another old person. We want someone closer to our age. And that suggests Kamala Harris, who's 54, not exactly spring chicken.
Cory Booker, but they are new faces.
It's a major, I think, argument, and it's crucial. I think if you look at history, American voters always give a bonus to a new face. I personally don't think that Joe Biden would be the right candidate or will even win the primaries
in
this
time. You're right, Philip. Bill Clinton and Barack Obama were new faces.
Yeah. And I think, and Donald Trump were the new faces. Oh, it's not a matter of age. It's a matter of being new on the scene.
I mean, two years before they won, that's a good point. Nobody knew who Bill Clinton was 2 years before
exactly.
He won. The same thing with President Obama. These were not household names.
And maybe a last thing on that. The more candidates you have, the less predictable, of course, is the race. And also, the most marginal the candidate, the ultimate nominee can be. That's what happened with Donald Trump. Put five Republican candidates in the race in 2016. I don't think Donald Trump would ever be the nominee. Put 16 of them. Then anyone getting 22-27% of the votes on a regular basis in every primary has a chance. The same may very well happen this time on the Democratic side.
With 15 of them on stage?
Yeah. And some very minority candidate can end up being the nominee.
Well, let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, go ahead and check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook, then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now, back to our panel, Philippe J. Lee, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Dan Ravid, National Correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News. Our moderator is White House Correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandes.
Welcome back. In Germany, the Munich Security Conference is underway. What's interesting is that a lot of the themes at this year's conference include things that probably weren't as problematic or uncertain or threatening even just a couple of years ago, things on the agenda like transatlantic cooperation, security implications of climate change in this renewed era of great power competition. These are things that are major concerns now that perhaps weren't even just a few years ago. Does this suggest, I'll start with you, Philippe, that is the world more unstable than it was a few years ago because of these new worries?
Well, in many ways, you can argue that the world is going backward in terms of arms race. The U.S. just denounced the INF Treaty. You have this big issue, this big elephant in the room that is Iran, just before Munich, a conference in Warsaw in Poland. So you have this situation where a lot of things that we had lost since the Cold War are coming back to us in a very strange way. And so the transatlantic alliance is in real bad shape when you see that the Americans can't even get top diplomats to Warsaw to discuss with them about the Middle East, when you see that the Europeans are setting up what they call a special purpose vehicle just to try to circumvent the U.S. sanctions against Iran. I mean, it's really a breakup. And when you listen what Vice President Pence said last week at this Warsaw conference, for the first time he attacked by name European allies for not being forthcoming with the United States and breaking up with them. And I think it's a really bad blood between the two sides of the Atlantic.
So the common thread here, Philippe, based on everything you're saying, is, and this is for you, Dan, is that it really is just the United States in the last 2 years taking a step back from the world stage and this traditional role that it's always had as the key player in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, for example, and on and on and on. It's no longer the confidence that the rest of the world doesn't have in the U.S. That's what it's really all about.
As you travel overseas, and all of us do that quite a bit, sure, that's what we hear. We have listeners all around the world, so they know that, but still it's a question of what came first. The American expression is, right, the chicken or the egg, right? Was the world already changing? One of the results is you get populist leaders like Donald Trump being elected. Not an intellectual. He is not personally well-read about the history of Europe or any other part of the world. He's going on his gut instinct, and he felt that already the transatlantic alliance, including NATO, is built on a lot of untruths. The U.S. is paying the bills, and we're not getting anything for it. He said the same to South Korea and Japan. We're protecting you. What's the point of that? Even in the Middle East, he said, why are we there at all? He talks about Afghanistan and wanting to get U.S. troops out of there, the sooner the better, without any reference to the attacks of 9/11 in the year 2001, and that's why the U.S. felt it had to be there. So he's tearing up history. Again, is he the one that caused the big change, or is he a symptom? Either way, I agree with you, gentlemen. The world has changed in the past 2 years, and for most people, not in the best way.
Well, it's interesting. The president, even some of these big concerns like climate change, and there's plenty of evidence, rising sea levels and more intense frequency and duration of storms and on and on and on, to suggest that this is a problem that is only going to get bigger. The president continues to deny it, even though his own Pentagon, the Department of Defense, says this is indeed a huge and growing national security worry.
Even again, he's reacting, the president is, with gut instinct. He said, it doesn't sound right to me. And he doesn't think of it as climate change. He's on that old phrase, global warming. And so again, in the past few weeks, with very cold weather in parts of the United States, he mocked the whole idea, saying it's so cold. That's not global warming. He's not an intellectual.
After 2.5 years, we know that this president never changed his mind on anything. Hmm.
Well, he might change what he does, because he's not always consistent in his actions, but in his gut core beliefs, whatever they're based on or not, you're right. He is what he was even 10, 20 years ago.
So we know he doesn't like alliances, permanent alliances. He doesn't have a strategic way of thinking and seeing things, like a long-term strategic positioning of the United States, be it in Europe or in South Korea. That doesn't speak to him. I think there is a mistake with the Europeans, and especially with NATO. He sees NATO as an alliance for war, which it is not. It's an alliance for dissuasion, for not going to war. And that relies on the belief that if you touch one of the members, you'll get all of them on your back.
It's interesting that the president doesn't seem to remember what happened right after 9/11, when our NATO allies flew missions along the eastern seaboard of the United States in the immediate aftermath of those attacks. It's a defensive alliance, and yet it doesn't quite seem to remember.
Its credibility is crucial. It's not about money. I mean, of course it is about money, and he's right in pointing the fact that a lot of members were not paying enough for their own defense. That's okay. And everybody agreed on that here in Washington. But if you ask the question, especially publicly, will we go to war to protect Montenegro, as it did a year and a half ago?
The president asked that question.
There you're totally misunderstanding the whole purpose of the thing. Because, again, it's not about going to war about Montenegro. It's about dissuading anybody to touch Montenegro. Because if you do, you will have all the 27 nations on your...
And, of course, making sure that Germany versus France never becomes a war again. And so,
hopefully.
But he would say, the president would probably say, NATO had its purpose. Now I want to repurpose it. I want to change it. I want it to work for America. Again, people around the world may wonder, what does the United States want? He's not committed to human rights. He's not committed to helping people around the world. His policy is America first. It's part of his campaign.
And it's in danger to becoming America alone.
Now, not in a defense of President Trump here, but I will point out that some analysts have said that what President Trump wants to do in terms of pulling back from these alliances, it's sort of what our very first president, George Washington, talked about. You know, friendship with all, but permanent alliances, no, that's not in the American tradition. It's fair to point out that's what our very first president said, but that was a long time ago. The world is obviously not exactly the same.
The world has changed, but who's to say that the way to go is the direction of so-called globalism, Paris climate change accords, promises, commitments, where the U.S., well, a lot of Americans who are, again, not generally experts in foreign affairs, but when they're told a couple of facts or a couple of figures, but not everything, say, wow, yeah, maybe we should be more isolationist. And, well, that's why Donald Trump won the election.
But just to end this topic, I mean, that's where you find yourself on Iran. That's how you find yourself alone and struggling to set up a coalition that goes beyond Israel or the Gulf states. And you want to gather the world behind you on Iran, and you don't find them anymore.
Well, in our remaining moments here, talking about sort of, you know, America's role in the world, and the president, I think we all can agree, said, well, I don't want America to be the world's policeman anymore. That's not our role. And yet he's been hinting about possibly sending thousands of American troops to Venezuela, which completely contradicts this talk about not being the world's policeman. What's that all about?
Well, early in his presidency, and don't forget he's been president now for 2 years, there were a lot of hints that he's interested in Venezuela. He would have meetings or phone calls with South American presidents. So whatever Donald Trump learned about Venezuela and pretty much an anti-U.S. government there, Trump got the idea he's an enemy. He's dangerous. He's either bad for resources or American corporations. No one has quite figured it out. But he was interested in Venezuela, and it's only in the past few months that apparently Trump and whoever is advising him on these things, including John Bolton, his national security advisor,
and Marco Rubio,
and Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, really cares about this. They speak about freedom for the Venezuelan people after this socialist, left-wing, horrible regime. Obviously, the U.S., meaning basically Trump, sees an opening. Maduro is weak. The economy is terrible. There's a chance to overthrow him. Is it U.S. agents? Is it perhaps a military intervention? President Trump this past week said everything's on the table. And the United States, and then some other governments too, recognize Juan Guaido as the legitimate president. So they've created a new hero.
Who's the head of the National Assembly.
It feels like a coup with U.S. support, but we don't know exactly what's going on.
It could be that, President Trump, it's interesting, just backstory here, that Venezuela has the world's biggest proven oil reserves, bigger than the Saudis, bigger than us, bigger than the Russians, bigger than anybody. And Trump seems to have a fixation on that. He's always talking about, oh, we should take the oil from the Middle East and this kind of thing. Is that a factor here at all?
Maybe. I think the reason for the different approach of the president on this issue is the Monroe Doctrine, basically. Latin America is our backyard, and we are not intervening in the whole world, but there, yes.
The Americas.
We had this scene quite striking with John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, being in the press room at the White House with a notebook marked 5,000 troops to Colombia. Venezuela has hundreds of thousands of people armed, including people militias called colectivos. There is a strong army which gets a lot of weapons from Russia. It is supported by Russia. The regime, the Maduro regime, is supported by Russia and China, who's invested $60 billion and still hopes to get back $20 billion that have been unpaid. So I don't think the president, I mean, of course he says everything is on the table. I think he's preparing to act in case American diplomats would be attacked, for instance, or maybe some commando special forces operation. But I think he's in a lack of a plan at this point. If the sanctions, the economic sanctions, especially on the oil, doesn't work, and if Maduro manages to stay in power, what does he do? What is the next step?
So in a way, it's sort of a proxy, perhaps, for this broader U.S. competition with great powers like China and Russia, perhaps.
That's part of the story.
Anyway, we'll have to end it right there. Thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Philippe Gilly of Le Figaro and Dan Raviv. He's with Israel's I-24 News. This program was produced by the Voice of America Current Affairs, our engineer Justin Thwaites, and I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports and USA Today. Thanks for listening.